Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
We're carrying forward our discussion of roads today to consider the situation with turnpikes as it developed in the 18th century, because the 18th century is the age of turnpiking. It's the last age, in fact, in which the roads, I mean, obviously canals were playing a role, but canals didn't play much of a role for passengers. It's the last age in which the roads totally dominate the system, which is an ironic way to look at it from the perspective of the motor car today. But the motor car today does, in fact, have to consider as well the train, whereas that was not a need in the 18th century. And what I want to try and do is to do what I've been doing so far, which is to counterpoint an emphasis on improvement and improvability, and to do that by also looking at issues of, you know, less significant progress. But let's start off with some of the standard indices, standard accounts that you would get. And, you know, these would emphasize the extent to which there was a substantial expansion in England in the 1750s and 60s, so that by 1770, there were about 15,000 miles of turnpiked roads in England. You will recall that contrasted with my suggestion that during the Roman period, there were about 2,000 miles of paved road and about 4,000 miles of unpaved road. And most of England was within 12 and a half miles of a turnpike. After 1751, it became easier to obtain turnpiked acts. I mean, Parliament really was passing them without too many difficulties. And by 1770, a network of turnpikes radiated from the major provincial centres. Now, I've, you know, sort of been following this through maps and other things and looking up some of the particular centres. So you take Chichester, for example, the major town in West Sussex. The first turnpike from Chichester was begun in 1749. So there was no turnpike there till then. But by 1779, 3 decades later, the city was the junction of 4 turnpikes. This led to an increase in overland trade from West Sussex to London and a relative decline in the longer sea route. Now, there are two ways of looking at that. You might say 30 years. Oh, my God, that's awful. And then we look at the time that public projects take today and we might say, well, actually, that's not too bad. The first Devon Trust, the Exeter, the first Devon Turnpike Trust, the Exeter Trust, was established in 1753. Rapidly followed by others, including the Tiverton Trust in 58, the Totnes one in 59, the Barnstable one in 63. The first trust in Cornwall, that to turnpike the Falmouth to Truro Road, was established in 1754. From Birmingham, by 1770, the convergence was quite clear. It benefited from routes, turnpikes to Bromsgrove in 1726, Hagley in 1753, and Dudley in 1760. And some towns benefited not just as major destinations for turnpikes, places like Birmingham, but also from being key points on the turnpikes in which you took on supplies and also from being junctions, for example, High Wycombe. And this helped to ensure an infrastructure, including inns and blacksmiths, that encouraged travellers to stop. And the individual consequences of turnpike roads were obviously different, but significant. Now, again, if we consider, we can look at it different ways. Take Lincolnshire, for example, which is, I think I'm right in saying, England's second largest county after Yorkshire and ahead of Devon. In 1756 to 1765, 13 new turnpike trusts were formed for Lincolnshire and 2 others were enlarged. The first road in North Lincolnshire to be turnpiked was that from Lincoln to Barton-on-Humber in 1765, from which a ferry went northwards. And, you know, you can look at maps and you could say, oh, well, this was very impressive. But, you know, there are actually contemporary accounts which suggest somewhat otherwise and which are worth thinking about. So in December 1782, I pulled out of an archive this one, Jeremy Lister, writing from Gainsborough, an area where, incidentally, the roads are still rather poor. Quote, "The roads are exceeding bad. The road toward Lincoln being the only one that is anything tolerable, and that in general is through very deep sand." So on the one hand, there were good roads. On the other hand, the situation wasn't so easy. Turnpiking both contributed to a system, but also was patchwork. And in part, it might complement river links. In part, it didn't. In part, there was at the greatest cities, such as London, an improvement in which turnpiking played a role. And for example, the new road, now the Marylebone, Euston and Pentonville roads, being paid by tolls. And in other parts of London, quite frankly, the roads were not marvellous. Similarly, the same variety could be seen in Wales or Scotland or Ireland. In Wales, important routes included which were turnpiked, including that from Hereford to Brecon in 1757 and on to Haverford West in Pembrokeshire in 1787, and from Cardiff via Neath to Carmarthen. In Montgomeryshire, a turnpike trust was authorised in 1769, and the first turnpike was in use from the early 1770s. But you know, the situation was not always marvellous. This is the traveller Richard Gough, and he's describing both the problem of going by boat and the problem of the roads. "We leapt the horses into a high boat. Both mine took it very well, both in and out." This was, of course, a ferry. "But Mr. Howells tumbled about very much, and his brothers, having been hurt at a former passage, made much worse work of it. The tides come in here exceeding strong. The horses were up to their bellies in water." That's when they have to get out of the ferry. "From Pembroke, the road steep, narrow and stony. The inns bad. From Carnarvon, the badness of the roads prevent travelling very fast. From Ruthin, as we get nearer England, the roads are kept up by turnpikes, and there are some new ones making." So in other words, yes, there are turnpikes in Wales, and no, they don't necessarily produce a system that eases much for the traveller. Or Ireland. An act of, because remember there was a separate parliament in Dublin, an act of 1729 established turnpike trusts, and local landlords could in fact encourage turnpiking for economic reasons, as in the Linen region of Ulster. But the travel writings of contemporaries such as Lord Chief Baron Edward Wiles, who's been published, that's for mid-century, leave few illusions about the problems. And it's quite clear that many Irish roads remained extraordinarily poor. So also in Scotland, incidentally, where, for example, the first turnpike trust in the northeast wasn't formed until 1795. Indeed, turnpiking itself was not always a solution, but rather a new context for activity, politicking and acrimony. So a letter in the Reading Mercury and Oxford Gazette of the 26th of October, 67, I note, reported the road at Henley, not exactly a town remote from London, being much worse than most people realised. And in the issue of the 3rd of February, 73, provided a letter from a commissioner for the Reading to Newbury Road to his fellow trustees, urging the sacking of the surveyor for failing to keep the road in repair. Turnpike trustees were able to call upon parishes to employ part of the labour stipulated in the parliamentary statutes of 1555 and 1563 for road repair. But the turnpike trustees found that parishes were often unwilling and were able to argue that their work on their local parish roads should take precedence. Separately, road repair methods were often limited. for example, that of ploughing up the surface in order to offer a fresh surface. The Chard Trust specified this method in 1753 and 1754. Didn't actually necessarily do much good on muddy soil. Problems with rainfall and drainage were such that it was regularly joked at Taunton that it would be less expensive to make the roads navigable for boats rather than passable for coaches. To this day, there are major inundations nearby, notably on Sedgemoor after heavy rain, and that can affect both roads and railways. Very differently, a local report in the Leeds Mercury of the 18th of October 1794 urged new surveyors to have sledgehammers available in every parish to break up the larger stones that were lying in nearly every road, and also pointed out that direction posts at crossroads were mandatory by law, and therefore it would be rather nice if a few of them were around. Furthermore, throughout the British Isles, many roads that were not turnpiked, for example, those on the Isle of Man, remained inadequate. There were many deficiencies. For example, North Devon had very poor land links and was largely dependent on shipping. By 1800, there were still no turnpikes between Biddeford and Launceston or between Ilfracombe and Linton, while in South Devon, the district of the South Hams was very poorly served. It's actually not very well served at the moment. More generally, drove roads remained crucial for animals, the turkeys being shod with tar for their long walk from Norfolk. In his play, She Stoops to Conquer, 1773, Oliver Goldsmith wrote of a rural journey, quote, "It is a damned long, dark, boggy, dirty, dangerous way." And many roads were exactly like that. This was somewhat different for the preference for travelling in pursuit of the picturesque character of many hilly or mountainous regions, such as the Lake District, the Peak District, the Wye Valley, and eventually the Scottish Highlands. Now, travellers were to wax eloquent about those by the end of the century, but the reality was that many of them found it jolly difficult to get into position for their picturesque experiences. On the other hand, there was a sense of new possibilities. Joseph Spence, visiting Scotland in 1760, commented, "They laid a map of the whole country before them, first marked lines of communication from the most considerable towns to the capital and to one another for the benefit of commerce and travelling, made a fund of £30,000 by a subscription, and began at once with 9 roads from Edinburgh, which are already branched out into above 30. I went no further than Glasgow," he was visiting from England. "All the roads very good and mostly made so within these 8 years. But in the Highlands, in contrast, the situation was not always so encouraging. 11 years later, Richard Gough wrote to his mother about travelling in the Highlands to Inverness and then on to Aberdeen. "The roads here were made by Marshal Wade's soldiers after the last rebellion and are kept up by the country people, for all the materials lie so near that they have nothing to do but throw them on as fast as the winter rains wash them off." I mean, that was a marvellous idea of a road surface. The rain runs, washes off the stones, and you then just chuck them back on again. "Ferried across 2 rivers, we were 4 hours on the water, and then got into a smaller boat, which soon run aground, and after waiting half an hour, we were carried to shore on men's backs. The great boat with the horses did not come up till noon." Not exactly the image created by Spence lying down a map and all these lines being drawn, laying down a map and all these lines being drawn across it. And as ever, with historical sources, you need to have both accounts. And as ever, so many of the writers on the period, both contemporary and subsequent, are flawed because they only look at it one way. Now, let us take at some other accounts. Literary ones are interesting because not just they reflect actually travellers who indeed went by road, but also because they helped to guide the response of others. So Tobias Smollett, a Scot, who had travelled and established himself in England, but still actually went back to Scotland. In his The Adventures of Lancelot Greaves, which was published in 1760, began, "It was on the Great Northern Road from York to London, about the beginning of the month of October, and the hour of 8 in the evening, that four travellers were by a violent shower of rain driven for shelter into a little public house on the side of the highway. But far from a dingy pub, this had a kitchen paved in red bricks, Windsor chairs, pewter plates, copper saucepans, and a cheerful fire of sea coal blazed in the chimney." And I think it's fair to say that on the whole, although there were many inadequacies, inns on the major roads by the end of the century were better than they'd been in the beginning of the century. And a traveller would find more frequent inns than possibly would be the case today if you were on a motorway. In his expedition of Humphrey Clinker, however, he was much less positive. The Bramble party set off northwards from London, fighting off highwaymen near Hatfield and pressing on to Harrogate. And it was in June. June was usually a good month for travel. The roads were usually dry and the rivers low. However, the roads, having been broke up by the heavy rains in the spring, were so rough that although we travelled very slowly, the jolting occasioned such pain to my uncle that that's Bramble, the squire, that he was becoming exceedingly peevish. Considering the tax we pay for turnpikes, the roads of this country constitute a most intolerable grievance. Between Newark and Wetherby, I have suffered more from jolting and swinging than ever I felt in the whole course of my life, though the carriage is remarkably commodious and the postilions were very careful in driving. However, subsequently, en route from Whitby to Stockton, so that was across North Yorkshire, quote, "crossing a deep gutter made by a torrent, the coach was so hard strained that one of the irons which connects the frame snapped and the leather sling on the same side. We were 8 miles distant from any place where we could be supplied with carriages. We discovered a blacksmith's forge about half a mile, and thither the postilions made shift to draw the carriage slowly, whilst the company walked afoot." Now, I think it's fair to say that was not what most people anticipated, walking. But nevertheless, that could be what you had to do. Or again, if you look at Smollett's The Expedition of Humphrey Clinker, again, if you're looking, for example, on the Marlborough Downs, one of the four horses fell in going down the hill at a round trot, and the position postilion behind, endeavouring to stop the carriage, pulled it on one side into a deep rut where it was fairly overturned. So, you know, you can have accidents. Well, yes, but I think it's fair to say that one of the major causes of accident was often crossing rivers on ferries. And that situation was eased by a measure of bridge building. Bridge building was important not only in the London area, where the second bridge across the Thames was built, which was Westminster Bridge in 1750, and that was rapidly followed by Blackfriars in 1769. But also there were bridges elsewhere. Now, the most famous one, of course, I suppose, is the one at Coalbrookdale in Shropshire, an iron bridge opened in 1781, and it very much showed progress in action. It had a 120-foot span. It carried the road on arched ribs springing from the bases of two vertical iron uprights, and the construction details were worked out by experienced iron founders. And it was a sort of vivid demonstration of the possibility of change. Elsewhere, there were other prominent new style bridges. So the Weir Bridge, which was an iron single span bridge built in 1796, was the first bridge in Sunderland. It replaced the ferry, and also it was a new lowest crossing point on the river. Hitherto the lowest crossing point was at Chesterley Street. So it changed the possibilities in Sunderland, and it changed the possibilities in Weardale. When built, it was the longest single-span bridge in the world, and high enough for large boats to pass underneath. And it didn't require replacing until 1729. And I'll just give you one or two other bridges, because in a sense, some of the individual bridges are impressive, some of them were less so, but they add up to quite considerable change. So Cambridge, for example, the Great Bridge was rebuilt in stone in 1754. In Bath, the old Bath Bridge was rebuilt the same year, and the Pulteney Bridge was added between 69 and 74. At Bristol, a new wide three-arched bridge over the Avon was opened in 1768. A stone bridge was built at Stockton over the Tees between 64 and 68, again replacing ferries and again providing a lower bridging point, in this case compared to Yarm. And Yarm became actually a quite quiet backwater, which is what it rests to this day. In Shrewsbury, the English Bridge, so-called, built between 1769 and 1774, was a seven-arch affair. A new crossing over the Ex in 74 provided the first bridging point below Exeter. If you can also see, for example, that although there was no new bridges across the Severn between 1540 and 1772, thereafter there were six more by 1850, and so on and so forth. So what one has got is a whole series of developments and replacements which alter the local economy and which reflect both experience and the application of science. So, for example, in Newcastle, the mathematician Charles Hutton, in his Principles of Bridges, which came out in 1772, sought to apply ideas of improved construction. This was impressive, but it didn't necessarily actually, it helped you to deal with ferries, didn't necessarily help to deal with the problem of transport on the roads. Controlling horses remained a serious problem, one requiring skill, especially going up and down slopes. Passengers were heavily dependent on this skill, and it underlined the dangers of travel and the need to hope that the coachman wasn't drunk. And road handling varied greatly depending on the nature of the road. So you needed to be an expert on what the actual nature of the road was. You know, for example, what were the local stones like? What weight would they carry? How would they respond to rain? How would they respond to saturation or to freezing? So visiting Sheffield in 1781, Silas Neville noted, "Roads about this town made with hard stone, not enough broken like some roads in the north." Bing found a bad stony road between Manchester and Stockport. Because narrow wheels dug ruts, commentators from the 1750s advocated broader wheels for carriages and wagons, and an act of 1753 stated that wheel rims on wagons had to be at least 9 inches wide. In the 1770s, James Sharp pressed for rollers 16 inches wide rather than wheels, claiming that they would consolidate the road surface and that his rollers approached the efficiency of railed roads, as the road and the vehicle were in effect part of the same mechanism. Despite parliamentary support, such rollers were impractical, however, as they were cumbersome and expensive, and indeed they also affected the road surface. Nevertheless, the road transport of freight improved with the introduction in the 1760s of fly wagons, and by changing teams of horses, these could travel day and night and could actually, you know, move goods quite considerable distances. So, for example, on the 5th of October 1791, the first number of the Newark Herald, Nottinghamshire and Lincolnshire General Advertiser. People liked long newspaper titles because they sort of indicated the potential market. The paper proclaimed its circulation. Being published early in the morning, so that's in Newark, it will be dispatched by the South Mail of that day to London and all the intermediate market towns, and by the North Mail and by posts at 2 o'clock, it will be forwarded to a number of key cities, including Newcastle, Hull, Leeds, York, Liverpool and Birmingham. In addition, in the following villages in the counties of Nottingham and Lincoln, it will be regularly published every Wednesday. So in other words, it was offering really quite considerable circulation. And such circulation was possible only because the road system was improving and because it was possible to have reasonable freight services on those. Now, I think it's fair to say that some links were better than others in terms of the regularity of coach services, in terms of their speed. It's generally agreed that the improved breeding of horses, both of English horses and crossbreeding of fast Arab horses, was a matter of improvement, as was the replacement of leather straps by steel coach springs and the introduction of elliptical springs. And the postal service is definitely sort of improved. And I think it's worth saying that you find much more frequent records and references in both literary sources, in pictures and in newspapers to new coaching services. So, for example, in 1790, the Southampton Frigate, and it's a symptomatic that they use that name for the coach service because that's a reference to a particularly nimble and speedy ship, began as a new thrice weekly coach service each way between Oxford and Southampton. And to attract customers, this service was advertised as part of a wider system, as at Southampton, the coach met the Brighton, the Chichester, the Lymington, the Poole, the Portsmouth, the Ringwood, and the Salisbury post coaches. And whilst from Oxford, there were daily post coaches to London, and at 7 a.m., 8 a.m., and 12 a.m., and to Birmingham, to Bristol, and to Worcester. So all of those provided the possibility for passengers. There was also developments in carrying services for freight. So, for example, turnpikes transformed the availability of fish, as noted in a York letter in the St. James's Chronicle of the 16th of March, 1765. Quote, "We see three or four times a week fish machines passing through the city." A fish machine is basically, it's water to keep the fish in, keep them being a bit fresh. "Passing through the city to Leeds, to Sheffield, to Doncaster, nay, as far as Derby and Worcester, of so great utility to the London of turnpike roads, to which place it was impossible before they were made to carry sea fish, either with proper expedition or security." So there was extraordinary increase in the availability of freight, and the development of turnpikes were very, you know, very significant in all respects. And on top of that, pack horse services became sort of more regular, more impressive, and it was thought, for example, that this helped to equalize costs across the country. I think we could pause at that point, because next time I'd like to go on to the 19th century. I wonder if there's any sort of things you might like to discuss about the 18th century, Graham.
Well, yes. Well, thank you very much, Jeremy. Very interesting what you have to say about the role of improved roads in whether it's transporting fish or transporting newspapers. Very interesting. I want to go back and start with a question about the Turnpike Acts in the 18th century. We talked in the previous episode about developments in Elizabethan England, but in the 18th century, were these Acts of Parliament, so an Act of Parliament is necessary to establish a turnpike trust to run the turnpikes. These Acts of Parliament, were they essentially copperplate acts where they're all identical with the same terms and conditions and you effectively just filled in the name of the Turnpike Trust? Or was there variety? How prescriptive were they in terms of, you know, what levies could be levied and what the expectation, the quality of the surfacing and its you know, continual improvement and updating would be?
Well, I think they are essentially copperplate, but on the other hand, the as indeed are enclosure acts, as indeed are another form of acts of parliament, which is the acts for the improvement of harbours or ports. All of those are classic instances of private legislation, and there's more private legislation passed in the 18th century than public legislation is passed. What essentially happens very quickly is the public legislation is the legislation at the beginning of the session and the private legislation at the end of the session. Now, you can vary that, but that's generally true. Now, are there different terms and conditions? Well, there's issues sometimes about routing, as indeed later is to happen with railways, because there can be different issue interests who quarrel about the route that they want followed. And sometimes these quarrels could be quite insistent because people have a differing view of what might suit the locality. But in essence, yes, they're copperplate. I would say that's the most reasonable way I would think that you could discuss it.
Mm-hmm. And how was the funding raised? Is it uniformly a levy on the local parish, or is at the start of each road there is a collector of a tariff?
Oh no, it's a tariff. There's not a local levy on the parishioners at all. I mean, and indeed, I think it's fair to say that parishioners often circumvented this by going on using the byroads. No, I mean, it's very much a financial proposition. It reflects confidence in the financial return and the security of the property and capital invested. And it reflects local investment capital, essentially.
And how significant would the tariffs being charged, the levies being charged, would they be? What were typical prices? And can you put those prices in the context of the age as to how burdensome they were?
They were burdensome for a lot of locals in particular. But I think what I would say is for through traffic, which could regain the cost or where people were willing to pay for speed, then it was worth having. But what you have is, you know, for example, most animals are still go on drove roads.
Mm-hmm. And it was we know with enclosure, there was often a lot of very considerable local opposition to what was going on. Was there something similar, organized opposition to turnpikes, with the view that, you know, that people were being charged to do things that they should be doing for free, albeit on a less good service? Or did people see it almost universally as a levy that was worth paying for a greater benefit?
Oh, God, no. No, there was a lot of opposition to turnpikes in some parts of the country. So, for example, I was looking at the archives in the northeast of England. In 1740, the inhabitants of Monk Wearmouth and Hedworth petitioned for exemption from the tolls for a proposed turnpike from Durham to Tyne Bridge. 4 years later, the proposed Newcastle to Alnwick turnpike faced, quote, this is a local writing, many difficulties as a result of local views. There was often a lot of opposition. There was a lot of hostility in the Bristol area. And then there were rows in Parliament. In 1749, William Wood noted, quote, the Duke of Bedford, that's John Fourth Duke, has had a contest with Lord Halifax, and others upon a road bill in the House of Commons, each of them contesting it through their allies there. So in other words, each want to dominate the trust and pick the route. a decade later, in 59, the editor of the Union Journal or Halifax Advertiser, I noticed, suggested that a road be built from Halifax via Sheffield to Mansfield in order to make travel from Halifax to London easier and thereby attract routes thither to go via Halifax. In other words, competition between towns, between economic interests, could play a role. And then other people just simply did not wish to pay the dues or felt they couldn't afford to pay the dues. And I think, you know, the latter is also a point worth mentioning, that, you know, they're not free, and it, you know, there is a social distinctions plays a role. I mean, remember, a lot of people walk still, and the people that walk are not exactly always delighted about, you know, they want things to be cheap.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true.
And of course, there were complaints between trusts. So neighbouring trusts might have stretches of the same road and hate it.
Right. And a final question, actually, about the nature of the trusts themselves. Are these trusts, as we would understand the term today, as a charitable body which must, you know, reinvest the revenue it makes in its own work, or were they essentially private companies by any other name which could generate profits, you know, pay off their contributors and shareholders and pay a dividend or you know, however they may be structured?
Well, they were time limited, but on the other hand, they tended to be rolled. In other words, they tended to be renewed. And in this sense, that what you're talking about is the absence in this period of a liability on local government to dramatically improve the nature of public transport.
Well, we must leave it there. We will pick up again next time. But for talking about turnpikes in the 18th century, Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
A pleasure.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.